talk to you soon.
Now, the circumstances here in the United States are so sick that I can't tell whether this teacher is saying this tongue in cheek, like saying, hey, listen, if we can't deal with guns, I guess we just turn the schools into prison like circumstances. And I don't know if he's saying it as in, like, obviously that's not a good idea, or if he's genuinely saying we've got to do that. The circumstances are so depraved that I don't know if he's being sarcastic or if he's just giving up and saying we have no other choice. That's exactly what we have to do. Wow. What a situation. We have a great bonus show for you today. We're going to continue talking about a number of different things. We're going to talk about a Juneteenth controversy. We're going to talk about a settlement involving Twitter and user data. On the bonus show, it's been a big shooting heavy show, so we're going to take a break from the shooting stuff on the bonus show. But unfortunately, I have way more to talk about tomorrow, including the forthcoming NRA convention. So you can sign up for the bonus show at joinpacman.com. And then otherwise, we'll be back tomorrow. And then we've got multiple streams coming up into the weekend, the NRA convention, the Trump rally in Wyoming, which I'm sure will be completely unhinged. So much cut.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
RCT Pittsburgh. Meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
These Republicans are out of touch on this issue. I don't want to take anybody's guns away. We need restrictions on assault rifles. We need wait times. We need red flag laws. I'm just tired. I'm exhausted.
Funerals are underway in Uvalde, Texas, for the 19 fourth graders and two teachers killed last week in the nation's deadliest school shooting in a decade. We'll speak to Texas State Senator Roland Gutierrez, who represents Uvalde, and confronted Texas Governor Abbott to call for a special session on guns. As questions mount over the hour it took for police to break into the classroom and kill the shooter, we'll also speak with Brandon Wolf, a survivor of the Pulse nightclub mass shooting in Orlando, Florida, where police took 3 hours to break into the gathering place of the LGBT community. 49 people were killed. It was the second deadliest shooting by a single gunman in U.S. history. Then to Colombia, where the presidential elections headed to a runoff.
Lo que se disputa hoy es el cambio.
What is in dispute today is change. The political parties allied to President Ivan Duque's government, President Duque itself, and his political project has been defeated.
Leftist candidate Gustavo Petro will face the right-wing populist Rodolfo Hernandez, who surprised many by placing second. Many have described Hernandez as Colombia's version of Donald Trump. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in Uvalde, Texas. Funerals are underway for the 19 fourth graders and two teachers killed a week ago when a gunman attacked the Robb Elementary School with an assault rifle he purchased just days after his 18th birthday. Over the weekend, the Justice Department announced it'll review the local police response to the massacre. Authorities now admit there were 19 police officers inside the elementary school shortly after the attack began, but they decided not to confront the gunman. Instead, they stood outside the classroom for about 50 minutes. During that time, at least two students and teachers repeatedly called 911 begging for help. On Sunday, President Biden visited Uvalde, joining a memorial for the victims at Robb Elementary School before attending Mass at the local Catholic church. Biden said after the visit, he hopes rational Republicans will agree to bipartisan gun legislation. Meanwhile, Texas Democrats are demanding Republican Governor Greg Abbott take action on guns. On Friday, Texas Democratic State Senator Roland Gutierrez, whose district includes Uvalde, interrupted Abbott at a press conference there, demanding he call a special legislative session to pass new gun controls.
I don't know how to express the loss of the families that I've talked to, and I know you feel it too. We have to do something, man. Your own colleagues are calling me, an 18-year-old shouldn't have a gun. This is enough. Call us back, man. Call us back.
Next question.
After headlines, we'll go to Uvalde, Texas, to speak with Texas State Senator Roland Gutierrez. According to the Gun Violence Archive, at least 8 people were killed and 55 others wounded in mass shootings around the United States over Memorial Day weekend. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has proposed new gun control laws in the wake of mass shootings in the United States. On Monday, Trudeau introduced legislation that would require most owners of military-style assault weapons turn over their firearms to a government buyback program. Trudeau also announced new regulations limiting access to handguns.
What this means is that it will no longer be possible to buy, sell, transfer, or import handguns anywhere in Canada. In other words, we're capping the market for handguns. We need less gun violence. We cannot let the guns debate become so polarized that nothing gets done. We cannot let that happen in our country.
Back in Texas, thousands of protesters gathered outside the National Rifle Association's annual convention in Houston over the weekend, condemning the gun lobby group for its opposition to gun control. The NRA gathering was held just 3 days after the mass shooting in Uvalde, less than 300 miles away. On Friday evening, former President Trump read the names of the Uvalde victims before delivering a keynote address to the NRA in which he demanded federal funding for more police officers and lethal weapons in schools.
Classroom doors should be hardened to make them lockable from the inside and closed to intruders from the outside. And above all, from this day forward, every school in America should have a police officer or an armed resource officer on duty at all times.
According to the Federal Election Commission, the NRA spent over $30 million on Trump's successful 2016 presidential campaign. Other speakers at the weekend NRA convention included Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, South Dakota Republican Governor Kristi Noem, and Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott, who appeared in a pre-recorded video. Musicians Larry Gatlin, Lee Greenwood, Larry Stewart, and Don McLean canceled planned appearances after the Uvalde shooting. In eastern Ukraine, Russian forces have entered the city of Severodonetsk and are battling Ukraine's army block by block. Witnesses report as many as 200 shells are falling on the city every hour, preventing rescue crews from counting the growing number of dead. Among those killed was French journalist Frédéric Leclerc-Imhoff, who was hit by shrapnel from a Russian shell that pierced the armored evacuation vehicle he and his colleagues were riding in. Ukraine's government says at least 32 media workers have been killed since Russia invaded in February. Reporters Without Borders Director General Christophe Deloire condemned Russia for the deaths.
Absolument révoltant. It's
absolutely revolting to see that in this conflict, there has been a continuous disdain for the Geneva Convention, that civilians are being shelled, that journalists who are civilians are being shelled, even though they have the right to protection according to international law.
The European Union has pledged to impose an embargo on most but not all of the oil it imports from Russia by the end of 2022. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen announced the emerging deal in Brussels Monday.
This is very important. Thanks to this, Council should now be able to finalize a ban on almost 90% of all Russian oil imports by the end of the year. This is an important step forward.
The EU's embargo would still exempt oil delivered from Russia by pipelines. It also grants Hungary a near-total exemption after authoritarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban refused to cut back on Russian oil imports. Iran's military has seized a pair of Greek oil tankers in the Persian Gulf. Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps says it took the action after Greece recently impounded an Iranian tanker and confiscated its oil, reportedly at the request of the United States, citing European Union sanctions. This comes as talks between the Biden administration and Iran aimed at restoring the 2015 Iran nuclear deal have stalled. In Brazil, at least 91 people are confirmed dead, with many more missing due to massive floods and landslides caused by heavy rains in the northeastern state of Pernambuco. Poor communities living in favelas in the city of Recife were among the most impacted, with landslides wiping away homes built on hillsides. Similar disasters have been recently reported in the mountains of Rio de Janeiro and other regions of Brazil as the country experiences more severe rainfall caused by the climate catastrophe. in Mexico. Hurricane Agatha made landfall in the southern state of Oaxaca Monday afternoon, becoming the strongest storm ever to make landfall in May in the eastern Pacific. The region, which is home to many beach towns and fishing villages, was hit with torrential rains, causing mudslides and power outages. The South Pacific island nation of Vanuatu has declared a climate emergency. Vanuatu's parliament unanimously passed a resolution Sunday introduced by Prime Minister Bob Laufman, saying the climate catastrophe is undermining the fundamental human rights of present and future generations. Speaking to parliament Sunday, the Prime Minister said Vanuatu is already disproportionately impacted by rising sea levels, devastating tropical cyclones, and other severe weather patterns triggered by the climate crisis.
The air is already too hot and unsafe. We are in danger now. Not just in the future. Catastrophic heat waves and bushfires, droughts and crop failures, and cyclones and coastal flooding are affecting Vanuatu and reaching around the globe. Coral systems are dying, and the world is now facing the sixth mass extinction in history.
In Colombia, leftist presidential candidate Gustavo Petro will face off against right-wing businessman Rodolfo Hernandez in a runoff election in June. Petro won Sunday's first election round with just over 40% of the vote, less than the majority needed to declare a first-round victory. In a surprising result, the far-right candidate Hernandez placed second. Hernandez is a real estate tycoon who once called himself a follower of Adolf Hitler. Petro is a former guerrilla member who has vowed to fight worsening inequality in Colombia with landmark policies, including a tax reform and redistribution of pension savings. His running mate is the Goldman Prize-winning environmental activist Francia Marquez Mina, who would become Colombia's first black vice president if they won. Both Petro and Mina have received several death threats throughout their campaign. We'll have more on Colombia's presidential election later in the broadcast. China's begun to ease COVID-19 restrictions in some of its largest cities. On Monday, workers in two districts of the capital, Beijing, were allowed to return to offices after authorities lifted some work-from-home rules and reopened public transit. Meanwhile, officials in Shanghai say they're preparing to lift a strict two-month lockdown on June 1st. Chinese President Xi Jinping has ruled out ending China's zero-COVID strategy, even as the nation struggles to stamp out its worst wave of coronavirus infection since early 2020. Here in New York, another prisoner at the Rikers Island Jail has died. New York's Department of Corrections says 20-year-old Emmanuel Sullivan was found bleeding from the nose and unresponsive in his cell Saturday afternoon. The cause of death is reportedly under investigation. He's the 22nd Rikers prisoner to die since 2021 and the 6th Rikers prisoner to die this year. In response, community organizer Rikers Island survivor Edwin Santana said in a statement, quote, "This tragedy should show every judge, prosecutor, and elected official who's ignored this truth before. Rikers is a death sentence. We don't need plans to create plans. We need action, and that action must include releasing people from the custody of an agency that cannot or will not keep them alive," unquote. And in labor news, at least 100 Starbucks stores have formed unions across the country. The historic milestone comes after two Starbucks in Seattle and one in Birmingham, Alabama, voted to unionize last week. Starbucks executives have responded with a campaign of retaliation against union efforts. The National Labor Relations Board says more than a dozen Starbucks workers have been illegally fired, as workers at hundreds of stores have filed for union elections since December, when a Starbucks in Buffalo, New York, became the first unionized store in the United States. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, funerals have begun in Uvalde, Texas, for the 19 fourth graders and their two teachers killed last Tuesday when an 18-year-old gunman attacked the Robb Elementary School. On Monday, funerals were held for two of the children, Mait Rodriguez and Amory Jo Garza. They were both 10 years old. Amory died while trying to call 911 as the gunman attacked her fourth-grade classroom. President Biden visited Uvalde on Sunday. After stopping at a memorial for the victims at Robb Elementary School, he attended Mass at the local Catholic church, where people chanted, "Do something," when he left. Over the weekend, the Justice Department announced it would review the local police response to the school shooting. Authorities have revealed there were 19 police officers inside the elementary school shortly after the attack began, but they decided not to confront the gunman. During that time, at least two students and teachers repeatedly called 911 begging for help. On Friday, Stephen McCraw, the director of the Texas Department of Public Safety, described the 911 calls.
So I warn you, it's not. It's better that I read it than you listen to it. The caller identified, I'll not say her name, but she was in room 112, called 911 at 1203. The duration of the call was 1 minute and 23 seconds. She identified herself and whispered, she's in room 112. At 1210, she called back in room 12, advised her multiple dead. 1213, again, she called on the phone. Again, at 1216, she called back and said there was 8 to 9 students alive. At 1219, the 911 call was made, and another person in room 111 called. I will not say her name. She hung up when another student told her to hang up. At 1221, you could hear over the 911 call that 3 shots were fired. At 1236, 911 call, it lasted for 21 seconds. The initial caller called back, student, child, called back, and was told to stay on the line and be very quiet. She told 911 that he shot the door. At approximately 1243 and 1247, she asked 911 to please send the police now. At 1246, she said she could hear the police next door. At 1250, shots are fired. They can be heard over the 911 call. And at 1251, it's very loud and sounds like the officers are moving children out of the room. At that time, the first child that called was outside before the call cuts off.
While children inside the school were calling 911, parents outside were begging officers to take action. The gunman was eventually killed by a Border Patrol tactical unit that disregarded orders from local police not to engage the gunman. During his news conference, Colonel Steve McGraw, the director of the Texas Department of Public Safety, admitted local officers made the wrong decision to wait an hour to confront the gunman. In a moment, we'll be joined by Texas State Senator Roland Gutierrez. He's a Democrat who represents Uvalde. But first, I want to turn to the state senator interrupting Texas Governor Greg Abbott's news conference in Uvalde on Friday.
The mayors and city council people, I don't know how to express the loss of the families that I've talked to. And I know you feel too. You have to do something, man. Your own colleagues are calling me. An 18-year-old chick shouldn't have a gun. This is enough. Call us back.
That was Texas State Senator Roland Gutierrez interrupting a news conference by Texas Governor Greg Abbott last week. He then walked out of the news conference. He joins us now on the phone as he drives back to Uvalde from his San Antonio office. Welcome to Democracy Now!, State Senator Gutierrez. There is so much to talk about. You have been right there on the front line. So we start with these 19 kids inside. A number are begging the police, calling 911, a few of them. Please come. We need a policeman. 19 kids die inside the classroom. 19 police officers are standing right outside the classroom. They don't move for 50 minutes. Can you talk about what you understand at this point happened and what you're calling for?
Yes, ma'am. So at 1203, as you know, those 19 officers were already in place. The initial response was 7 officers. 4 ISD officers and three city, and I may be conflating those two. It might be four police and three ISD. Nevertheless, there was seven officers in the building. They made attempts to go down the hallway. The shots were being fired at that time. You know, we were told that there was negotiations in one of those McGraw reports. He later admitted that there were no negotiations. The man did not communicate a single word to police at that time. Shots were continuing to be fired, and I think that that's what will be coming out in this federal investigation that's being undertaken at this time. As you
Senator,
know, nobody winning.
Senator, I just wanted to ask you: do you have an understanding, or has you been told who was the incident commander at the scene? Because clearly, every law enforcement response requires an incident commander to give the orders. Was that Chief Arredondo, the head of the school district police, or was it the local police or the state police?
So that is what DPS is saying. They are saying that they're putting this on Chief Arredondo. I don't know Chief Arredondo. I've never met Chief Arredondo. I find that the failures that occurred here are not just a failure on this so-called incident commander. The active shooter protocols indicate that you are to go in. If law enforcement is present, you just go in. And so I don't know at what point that should trump the incident commander protocol. But at the end of the day, the federal government employees, CBP employees, they had had enough. They said, the hell with it, and we're going in. At the end of the day, law enforcement is there. We have active shooter protocol that dictates what people should do. We're putting this on the local cop who has six cops under him. At what point do the police of Uvalde not overtake this responsibility? At what point do the Texas state troopers undertake the responsibility? Greg Abbott has put this Operation Lone Star down there. We have 150-plus extra state troopers in the area, and you see them waiting outside. You see, according to Colonel McGraw, he told me on Saturday, we had a long, long discussion Saturday morning, very painful discussion. He told me that there was two troopers in the hallway. I have asked for a further report. I want to know when each officer arrived, because we have this technology, where they were situated, whether they were in the hallway, whether they were outside, why were any officers outside by the windows. Listen, I'm not a police officer, and I'm certainly not an expert in these types of things, but it seems like there was a tremendous amount of failure. To put it on one local cop is just, it's beyond me.
And could you, you've talked with many of the parents. What did they tell you about how they were dealt with while they were waiting outside frantically to know the fate of what was going on with their children?
So we've been very, very respectful with the parents. I have talked to a handful of them. We go in. I don't want to impose myself at this time on families. I've talked to about five. And every day we seek to lightly talk to parents. My biggest concern with one couple was that their child was wounded simply by one bullet, that according to their first responders, that child likely bled out, shot in the kidney area. Who knows how long she was alive for? And we had officers go in a timely way, as the active shooter protocols dictate, that little girl might be alive. Those are the kinds of facts that need to be fleshed out. Why? Because we need to ensure that this never, ever happens again, because we know that it will. We know that the tragic, that the horror is going to happen again in this state or in some other state. We have to know that law enforcement will act differently, that they will do their jobs and execute well. If the policy is indeed that the incident commander is the local school cop, well, then by God, we need to change that. At some point, the next superior force should take over. And so it's my hope that new policies will be in place going forward so that no community has to deal with the aspect that law enforcement failed them.
So, State Senator Gutierrez, a lot of attention is being spent, paid to this aspect, the utter failure, and also the violating of the parents outside. Apparently, there was tasers used. One woman was handcuffed. You had fathers begging, give me your gun to the police. I'll run in. Give me a shield. I'll run in. But then there's this larger issue that you took on with Texas Governor Abbott, interrupting his news conference on Friday, calling for a special session of the Texas legislature. Talk about what you overall think needs to happen. I mean, clearly these men in the hallway were afraid because there's a man there with a semi-automatic rifle, okay, 18 years old, but he is gunning people down. What needs to happen? How do the laws need to change?
So let's be clear where the failure begins. And the failure begins, and, you know, I've been accused of politicizing this issue. At the end of the day, I'm in a building that people elect me to fix problems. The failure begins with Greg Abbott, who's undergone with 7 or 8 mass shootings in his tenure. And he's done nothing but give greater access to militarized weaponry. His seminal attempt to fix things in 2019 was more school hardening. A lot of good that did these kids. We have to take militarized weapons off the street. And if we're not going to do that, maybe that's a federal issue, perhaps. If we're not going to do that in the state of Texas, you know, I'm in a business where I have to compromise with these people on the other side. Under no circumstances, it's the law in Texas that you be 21 years old to go out and get a handgun. Why in the world can you be 18 years old and buy an AR-15? It's easier to get an AR-15 in Texas than it is to buy baby formula these days. And that's the sadness of it all. We can have red flag laws, or we can have a 10-day waiting period. Just like Greg Abbott has spent $6 billion on the border, we can scrape off a few million creating a Texas-sized ATF, where someone goes off and gets an AR-15, they wait a 10-day waiting period. They get interviewed by this Texas-sized ATF. So that would eliminate the notion of a red flag law because you'd have this interview process. We're not taking anybody's guns away. We're just interviewed by officials that are supposed to know the profiles. And then we figure out the details later on those types of issues. But those are things that we should be talking about. Limits on magazine capacity, sure. But the biggest thing is we've got 70% of these crimes that are being perpetrated around this country are being committed by people that are under 21 years old. And yet in Texas, you can walk around, by the way, with your AR-15. Last session, they passed open carry. The last thing, I was one of the last speakers to speak. The last thing I said, the last 10 seconds, I said, because of this bill, kids are going to die. Never in my wildest dreams did I think that that bit of hyperbole was going to happen in my own community. And I feel like I'm living in some kind of strange horror film.
Well, Senator, when President Biden visited Uvalde on Sunday with his wife, many of the people there chanted to the president, do something. What do you think that President Biden should do?
Well, look, I mean, he said it already. And by the way, they chanted some horrible, horrible things at Greg Abbott that same day. And it was more than just do something. People are mad. They're frustrated. Republican constituents are telling me we need to change this 18-year-old bit. President Biden has done every executive order that he can do on this stuff. At the end, we need Congress to act. And the House can pass whatever they want right now, but they're being stymied by a United States Senate that cannot break the filibuster. You've got 10 Republicans that need to move, or you need to have Democrats that are going to have the fortitude to break the filibuster. And so we are in this logjam. It is so a bought and paid for logjam by the National Rifle Association. And where we are, it's just these politicians, I didn't say public servants, these politicians in Washington, and politicians like Greg Abbott, they are are just cowards that they can't stand up to this organization. I've been here every day. I haven't been home. I go home at night, at midnight. I come back out at 6, 7 in the morning every day, and I spend my entire days here just talking to people. They have to know that government's going to be here. I'm trying to get resources to the community. It's easy to say something, but just like my wife says, it's about actions. You know, the governor's second, the reason I interrupted that press conference, it was very organic. I was all the way across town as I listened to it. He didn't invite me to it in my own district, first off. Secondly, it was just some perfunctory press conference about the existing services that the state of Texas has to offer these families. And they're pretty minimal, by the way. If you're the governor of the great state of Texas, you would think that you would come down with your checkbook in hand and make sure that we had mental health services in Uvalde, which we don't have. You'd make sure that families had real victim assistance program. How are we going to expect these poor people to go to work? And yes, there's money flowing in for sure. But it's the kind of situation that they're getting access to these monies right now is tremendously difficult.
Do you have any faith in your Texas Senator Cornyn, who Mitch McConnell has appointed to the Senate Minority Leader, to work with Senator Murphy of Connecticut, of course, represents Sandy Hook, Blumenthal also of Connecticut, and others, to come up with gun control legislation? Do you think for a moment, though it didn't happen in massacre after massacre, do you think for a moment this could be a breaking point? And also, what are the plans for the Robb Elementary School? You've been talking about having it razed and rebuilt because the kids don't want to return.
Well, I'll tell you that my plans immediately are something that began with a talk with the president last week, that president's staff last week, and it was the idea that we discussed raising the school, or they brought up the notion of raising the school. I didn't really realize at the time that there is a federal protocol for this. There's actually a grant that gives upwards of $45 million for schools devastated by this type of violent catastrophe. What does that say about our country, that we have a process like this? It's astounding to me. And so far as I know that Senator Murphy's out there is trying as best he can. I hope he can open some hearts and minds. I'm hoping that Cornyn listens. I've known John Cornyn since I was a kid, since I was a law student. I used to deliver his books when he was a district court judge, his courtroom. I asked him last week when I saw him, I said, Senator, we need something. And, you know, he told me what these people always tell me, you know, well, we're working on it. You know, it's just not good enough. It's not good enough. I mean, we need to do something better than what we're doing. And it's just not there.
Well, Roland Gutierrez, I want to thank you for being with us. We don't want to keep you anymore. I know you're on the road to Uvalde right now. Democratic Texas State Senator who represents Uvalde in the Texas State Legislature. Thanks so much for joining us, and be safe. Next up, as questions mount over the hour it took for police in Uvalde to break into the classroom and kill the shooter, we're going to go to Florida, to Brandon Wolf. He's a survivor of the Pulse nightclub mass shooting in 2016, where police took 3 hours to break into that gathering place of the LGBT community. 49 people were killed in the second deadliest shooting by a single gunman in U.S. history. Stay with us.
Cuando un amigo se va, queda un espacio vacío que no lo puede llenar. La llegada de otro amigo, cuando un amigo se va, queda un tizón encendido.
Maria Martha Serra Lima. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As police in Uvalde, Texas, face harsh questions in a federal investigation into how they apparently waited almost an hour to get a key from a janitor before moving in to kill the shooter, other survivors of mass shootings have been speaking out about the pattern of delays. Our next guest, Brandon Wolf, survived the second worst gun massacre in recent U.S. history when a gunman opened fire on the dance floor of the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida. We're coming up on the sixth anniversary. It was June 12, 2016. Brandon's best friend, Drew, was among the 49 people killed in the attack, which came in the middle of Pride Month. Witnesses described scenes of the terror inside the club.
He just kept on shooting and shooting and shooting and just walking around. No, it was rapid fire. It's like, and then he'd like change, put another ammunition, and then change, put another ammunition. And I could just smell the ammo in the air. And I was like, this is a gun. This isn't fireworks. Like, we need to leave.
That was 6 years ago. Many of those killed were young Latinx members of the LGBTQ community. Survivors say they faced a three-hour wait for police to respond and that some of those who died may have lived if they'd gotten help sooner. Now, as the Pulse nightclub attack's sixth anniversary approaches, survivors hold a vigil for the victims of the Uvalde massacre. For more, we go to Orlando to speak to Brandon Wolf, Pulse nightclub massacre survivor, now a gun safety and LGBTQ civil rights advocate. He is now press secretary for Equality Florida. He wrote a piece for Oprah Daily after the Uvalde massacre headlined, "Gun Violence in America is a Solvable Crisis, So Why Haven't We Stopped It?" Brandon, first I'm going to say condolences because we haven't spoken and I am sure you relive this all the time. Where were you that night? And then talk about when you heard about what happened in Uvalde and what you think needs to happen.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It is really painful to go through this over and over again. And it's always especially painful when we're talking about children because the last 6 years have been really hard for those of us in the community, especially those who lost someone. And so my heart breaks for folks in Uvalde, their families, their friends who will never be the same. I was washing my hands at a bathroom sink when gunshots rang out at Pulse nightclub. And it's important to note that Pulse was one of the safest places I knew. For LGBTQ people, and especially LGBTQ people of color, there are not safe spaces in the same way that there are for others. For me growing up, home was not always a safe space. Church was certainly not a safe space. School was not always a safe space. And so we created safe spaces for one another. Pulse was one of those spaces where I felt like I could be me without fear of violence or discrimination. Then of course that safe space was invaded. The man who perpetrated that violent and heinous act at Pulse was carrying a Sig Sauer MCX. It's been referred to as the AR-15 of the future. He fired over 110 rounds into the club, and it took us over 36 hours to learn the fate of my best friends, Drew and Juan. But ultimately they took 19 of those rounds. One died on an operating table and the other never made it off the dance floor. And so my initial thought or reaction to what happened in Texas is heartbreak, but also anger and rage, because no one should have to live through what I lived through 6 years ago. And it begs the question that I asked in that Oprah Daily piece, what are we doing? Why haven't we been able to solve this? Why are we so paralyzed by the gun lobby and gun manufacturers in this country? Why are we so paralyzed by the sort of rhetoric and talking points that have frozen us that we can't just sit at a table and say our kids deserve better? We should be able to send our children to school so they can learn math and reading and science, not so they practice hiding under their desks, all so that one day a man can charge through the front door and end it all. This country has to have a really hard, tough, honest conversation about its obsession with easy access to firearms. And I think we need to hold our lawmakers accountable in different and more creative ways. It's not enough for them to sit there in a press conference and tell us that they're working on it. They've been working on it for decades, maybe even centuries, and it's not working. And it's time for us to ask for something different.
And Brandon, in addition to the issue of the paralysis of our leaders in terms of gun safety, this issue of the response of the police, the 78 minutes that transpired in Uvalde before the police actually shot the gunman, there was an even longer response time at the Pulse nightclub. Was there ever any analysis afterward of how the responders, the police and law enforcement responded that night at the nightclub?
There was, and I'll say I think it has left people wholly unsatisfied. There was an investigation done by the state attorney's office. They focused their investigation on whether or not police officers inadvertently shot and killed people as they were shooting indiscriminately inside the club. They determined that all of those who passed away were killed by gunfire from the gunman himself, but they didn't dive deeply into whether or not anyone should be held accountable for the inordinate amount of weight that people had to suffer before police breached the building. In fact, that same report that came out, that internal investigation showed that 13 people died in the bathrooms of Pulse nightclub during that three-hour wait. Those 13 people were being held by their friends and cousins and other family members as they bled out on the floor. And police had a litany of reasons or excuses why they didn't go into the building. But I think it underscores a couple of things. First and foremost, we have a significant problem. If we have been dealing with this now for decades and police forces, law enforcement agencies across the country don't have a functional response yet to how they address mass violence in schools or nightclubs or, you know, or grocery stores or churches or all the other places that this is happening, we have a serious problem. At the very least, you would think that law enforcement agencies would be speaking to one another, that they'd be able to solve the basic struggles of when to go in, how to go in, what gear that they need in order to safely, you know, go through the front doors and take care of what needs to be taken care of. But I think it also raises this other question, which is why are we continuing to focus our efforts on what happens when a shooter is already inside the building? If we continue to double down on this idea that, you know, we need more armed security, we need more police officers at more checkpoints, then we've already resigned ourselves to the fact that gun violence is inevitable in this country, and we know it's not. This is the only industrialized country in the world where this happens. We have more guns per capita than any other country on earth, and it's not even close. So this idea that more guns make us safer and that we've just got to wait and make sure that police officers have the right tools and resources to be able to respond, it's simply not working. It is a logical fallacy. The data tells us otherwise. We have to be honest about stopping gun violence before it erupts in the halls of our school instead of waiting to assess whether or not police officers responded in the right way once it's over.
Brandon, we just have a minute. You're in Florida, where the Don't Say Gay legislation was passed. We are seeing book bans around the country, lifting of gun bans, and imposition of abortion bans. Your comment?
It's absurd. It's outrageous. And it again begs the question, what are we even doing right now? These right-wing politicians have been shoving an agenda down our throats for over a year now. They've told us that the greatest threats our kids face are that they might learn that this country was built on the backs of enslaved Black people, or that their teacher uses they-them pronouns. And all along, we know what's actually killing kids. Gun-related injuries are the number one cause of death for American children. That is a crisis. It is a public health crisis. And instead of focusing on these culture war boogeymen that are helping them climb the political ladder, these politicians should be focused on keeping our kids alive, on sending them to school so they can thrive, not simply on helping themselves reach the next political destination.
Brandon Wolfe, we thank you again for being with us. Pulse nightclub massacre survivor, now a gun safety advocate and LGBTQ civil rights advocate, press secretary for Equality Florida. In 30 seconds, when we come back, we go to Colombia to learn about the presidential election that's leading into a runoff. Stay with us. Bye. Nido Pimienta. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In Colombia, the leftist presidential candidate Gustavo Petro will face off against right-wing businessman Rodolfo Hernandez in a runoff election in June. On Sunday, Petro won the first round with just over 40% of the vote, falling short of the 50% needed to avoid a runoff. Petro is the former mayor of Bogota, former member of the Colombian guerrilla group M19. He's vowed to fight worsening inequality in Colombia with landmark policies, including tax reform and redistribution of pension savings. He spoke to supporters Sunday night.
What is in dispute today is change. The political parties allied to President Ivan Duque's government, President Duque itself and his political project has been defeated. I believe that the total vote in Colombia sends that central message to the world. A period is ending. An era is ending.
Earlier on Sunday, Gustavo Petro spoke to reporters after casting his vote.
We came to do our exercise, to vote. I trust in the Colombian society and in their desire for change. In the end, there are only two alternatives. It's a relatively simple election, to leave things as they are in Colombia, which, in my opinion, means more corruption, violence, and hunger. Or to change Colombia and take it towards peace, prosperity, and democracy for the people.
Gustavo Petro's vice presidential running mate is the Goldman Prize-winning environmental activist Francia Marquez Mina, who would become Colombia's first black vice president if they win the runoff. Rodolfo Hernandez's second-place finish surprised many. He received 28% of the vote. Another right-wing candidate, the establishment candidate, Federico Gutierrez, placed third with 23%. Together, the two right-wing candidates received about 52% of the vote, almost 11 million votes. Petro received about 8.5 million votes. Rodolfo Hernandez is a former mayor, a real estate tycoon. He's been compared to Donald Trump. He ran on an anti-corruption platform, but is under investigation himself for graft. Hernandez once described himself as a follower of Adolf Hitler.
I am a follower of a great German thinker. His name is Adolf Hitler.
Rodolfo Hernandez later said he meant to say he was a follower of Albert Einstein, not Hitler. For more on the Colombian election, we're joined by Manuel Rosenthal, Colombian physician, activist with more than 40 years of involvement in grassroots political organizing with youth, indigenous communities, and urban and rural social movements. He's been exiled several times for his political activities, part of an organization called Pueblos en Camino, or People on the Path. He lives in the Cauca region of Colombia, joining us, though, now from Toronto, Canada. Manuel, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about the significance of this election that's leading to a runoff.
Good morning, Amy and everybody. Yes, to talk about the significance of this, I have to, first of all, express my deepest condolences to the people of Uvalde, the families and the families of the children and the teacher, and the fantastic, extraordinary, clear statement by Brandon Walsh. And I have to make a link between what they're going through and what we go through that will help us understand these elections and what's going on in Colombia. Just on the 28th of March, we helped denounce, I wrote about it myself, a massacre committed by the Colombian armed forces in Putumayo, in the border with Ecuador. 11 unarmed civilians were murdered, and this was announced by President Duque and his Minister of Defense as an attack, as an armed and combat operation against FARC members in arms. This was all a lie. The testimonies of the people in the community, brave enough while surrounded by the army, proved that it was an open massacre committed by the army. There have been more than 70 massacres committed in Colombia, all ready this year. And President Biden, 2 days before the referendum that chose a presidential candidate, and just on the 23rd of May, announced that Colombia has been supported by his government to be join NATO as an extra member. In other words, that Colombian army that he has been involved in the massacre of innocent civilians, that is corrupt, that is involved in that drug trafficking, which has been exposed everywhere, that Colombian army that has become involved in the electoral policies, its commander-in-chief announcing that if Petro wins the election, he will not support him, violating the Constitution, is being supported by President Biden, not only by providing further funding, research, support for army and more weapons to Colombia, but is also, at the same time, the Colombian police that acted on the peaceful uprising in Colombia, murdering, disappearing, torturing, has received 3 bases as a gift from President Biden. So the parallel is obvious, and what goes on in Colombia is massive. What are these elections about? And beyond the elections, what is going on in Colombia? What is going on in Colombia is a popular uprising now being expressed through the electoral process against the status quo that is exactly what Brandon Wolf described for the U.S., but a part of the state structure. So it is a little crack in the wall, a hopeful crack in the wall, to begin to change the status quo of murder, corruption, and all for the benefit of corporate and elite interests there and elsewhere.
Well, Manuel Rosenthal, in terms of, though, the rise of Rodolfo Hernandez, which surprised many, the establishment candidate was Federico Gutierrez. But now it appears that Gutierrez and the entire political and economic elite are rapidly uniting behind Hernandez. So it is going to be a tough fight for Gustavo Petro to be able to win the runoff, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's frightening. The Federico Gutierrez, the official candidate of the far right of President Uribe, of drug trafficking, of the mafia, he lost to Rodolfo Hernandez. Federico Gutierrez had openly stated, and this is on massive media, it was during a presidential candidate debate, he openly stated that Rodolfo Hernandez is a corrupt, he has a process against him, he's about to be sentenced, and that he should not be supported. As soon as Hernandez won the second place, he announced that he would vote for him for the good of Colombia. So the problem now, Colombia, the electoral process in Colombia and the entire country, not only the electoral process, is fraudulent in Colombia. And fraud is not only in the counting of votes. It's not only the day of the elections. It's not only buying voters. It is a sophisticated, established mechanism that has been there for many years, involves violence, involves terror, etc. So now what's actually happening is exactly what Amy said in the beginning. The 28% votes that Hernandez has and the 23% votes that Fico Gutierrez had are going to be added up by the far right to defeat Gustavo Petro. And behind all this, there's fear, there's terror, there's manipulation. And so Petro has, and the campaign for Petro has, basically a little more than 2 weeks to gather more than a million votes and defeat a misogynous, corrupt politician that people would understand the parallels with Trump. He campaigned only on TikTok. So that is what is going on in the electoral picture, which is not enough to explain the context of democracy in Colombia.
And there's been a lot of attention to the running mate of Gustavo Petro, Francia Marquez, who would be the first woman, an Afro-Colombian woman to to hold such a high post. But what about the vice presidential candidate of Rodolfo Hernandez, Marilyn Castillo? What can you tell us about her?
Well, it's also very unusual. First, I want to say a couple of things about Francia Márquez and Gustavo Petro that are very important. Gustavo Petro is probably the strongest, most knowledgeable, critical voice of the Colombian establishment from within. He has denounced the paramilitaries. He has denounced the relationship between paramilitaries and politicians, where the Colombian Congress, 35% of it was taken by paramilitaries. This was denounced by Petro. Drug trafficking, corruption, and not in theory, providing evidence, facing death threats, etc. So probably the strongest, most clear and critical voice of the Colombian establishment, the rotten establishment of Colombia, is Gustavo Petro. On the other hand, Francia Márquez was probably one of the strongest Afro-Colombian women who mobilized from the ground, from the bases, against transnational, legal, illegal mining, corporate interests. And she actually went to the Ministry of the Interior with women, walked to Bogota, and made one of the most extraordinary statements for the Afro-Colombian people and women and for all Colombian people that anybody has heard. So the two of them have a legitimacy with regard to the critical approach to this establishment, and they do threaten what is established there. Rodolfo Hernandez, on the other hand, and you must understand this clearly, portrays himself and has done a campaign as an anti-establishment candidate. So, in fact, if you add Petro's votes, 41%, and Rodolfo Hernandez, there was a massive anti-establishment vote. And one believes that many, many of the people who voted for Hernandez honestly believed that he was his promises of finishing with corruption. He lies, he manipulates, and that is confusing a lot of people. And it is confusing people in a context where political participation and activity has been reduced to voting, and even voting and electoral processes have been reduced to a preconceived and pre-manipulated outcome. In Colombia, only the elites and only the mafias win, and that you have really no choice beyond that. So what is missing in Colombia and has been missing in Colombia all along is the fact that politics are not just voting. In fact, voting should be the least component of voting. We can and we must construct our education systems, our health system, our security system, our autonomies in order to achieve peace and democracy. And that has been systematically denied, is being denied, and we run the risk even with these elections that the electoral promises and the faith in a government changing a reality that can only be changed by the people becomes the issue again. And that explains why Rodolfo Hernandez, in part, gained so many votes. It's the fact that people want to vote against the establishment because there are very few and very small avenues to act politically otherwise.
So you're saying that it could be that they just won't join together to beat Petro and Márquez. Finally, we just have 20 seconds. But how dangerous is this for Petro and Márquez? Some of their speeches they give behind bulletproof shields. They've had death threats against them.
Absolutely. Extremely dangerous to them. Extremely dangerous to everybody in the whole country. There was an armed strike by paramilitary forces throughout half of the country. This is linked to the armed forces. Yes, it's dangerous for them, for everybody. We all live, including Francia and Gustavo, under constant death threats and under a state of genocide.
We have to leave it there. We will continue to follow this, of course. Manuel Rosenthal, Colombian physician, activist, part of Pueblos and Camino, People on the Path. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Angie Karen. Welcome back to Torino Nudura. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez.
WRCT Pittsburgh. It's more fun when it doesn't make any sense.